From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One sign that Christmas is coming is the annual CBS broadcast of A Charlie Brown Christmas. It aired earlier this week. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the creator of Peanuts, Charles Schulz, who is still drawing it today. A Peanuts musical will be coming to Broadway in February. A Christmas season tradition on public radio is the Santaland Diaries, David Sedaris' journal about the Christmas season he spent as an elf in Macy's Santaland. The journal is included in his book, Holidays on Ice. We'll feature a reading from the book, and we'll talk with Sedaris about his Christmas memories. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a CD he recommends for the holiday season, featuring choral music with spiritual fervor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A Miami federal judge says Florida's law against so-called partial birth abortions is unconstitutional. The law adopted during the 1997 legislative session made it a third-degree felony to perform the rarely used abortion procedure, described by opponents as partial birth abortions. A temporary restraining order was imposed in June on the day the law was supposed to go into effect. Iraq's media is criticizing efforts by the U.S. and Britain to persuade Iraqi exiles to topple President Saddam Hussein. Meanwhile, the U.N. Security Council meets today to discuss Baghdad's cooperation over arms documents. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
Baghdad's state-run press has accused Washington and London of promoting evil ideas and schemes. It claims the two are trying to interfere in Iraq's internal affairs after they failed to unseat Saddam Hussein through military strikes and sanctions. Yesterday, Britain hosted a meeting of 16 Iraqi opposition groups in the hopes of improving the chances of overthrowing Saddam. The meeting coincided with the news of the abortive attempt on the life of Saddam's top deputy, Izzat Ibrahim, in the Shiite city of Karbala on Sunday. The press alleges Iranian involvement in the failed assassination plot. Baghdad is pleading with Arab nations to help lift UN sanctions and thwart British-American plans to topple the Iraqi regime. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
A huge windstorm swept through the Pacific Northwest, killing one person and leaving tens of thousands of others without power. From KUOW in Seattle, Robert Smith reports.
The windstorm came off the Pacific coast with rains and winds gusting up to 74 miles per hour. Trees were blown over onto houses and power lines. More than 200,000 people in the Northwest are waking up without power. The Seattle-Tacoma International Airport lost its electricity overnight. Emergency generators kept runway lights and navigation beacons on, but baggage carousels, ticketing computers, and security x-rays were shut down and flights were delayed. There is one reported casualty from the storm. A woman north of Seattle stopped her car to investigate a brush fire. She was electrocuted by the arc from a downed power line that had started the blaze. For NPR News, I'm Robert Smith in Seattle.
Russian lawmaker Galina Starovoitova was given a hero's funeral today in St. Petersburg. Two former prime ministers turned out for the service, after which she was buried alongside some of Russia's greatest national heroes. Investigators are still searching for the killers. Hundreds of student demonstrators today demanded the ouster of Indonesia's military chief. At least nine student protesters were killed during clashes with soldiers earlier this month. Although the nation's military commander had ordered riot officers to carry only blanks and plastic bullets, doctors say they found metal bullet fragments in some victims. Military officials said today 163 soldiers involved in the clashes could face courts-martial. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, one day after setting a new record, the stock market is showing some signs of cooling off a little today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The market is apparently taking a breather today after yesterday's big 214-point run-up. Stocks set the new record largely due to a slew of mergers. It was announced this morning, meanwhile, that one of the biggest of those deals, the marriage of America Online and Netscape, has now been finalized. AOL confirmed today it's agreed to buy Netscape for $4.2 billion in stock. The company also said it's entered into a separate agreement with Sun Microsystems to handle Netscape's business software. International Paper announced today it's buying Union Camp in a deal with debt factored in is worth more than $6.5 billion. On the economic front, the government announced the gross domestic product, that's the total of all goods and services moving through the economy, expanded by 3.9% in September. Consumer confidence was up in November after four straight down months. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
General Mills said today it would streamline its manufacturing, distribution, and sales operations and take a $32 million after-tax charge to cover the restructuring. The nation's second-largest cereal maker said the charge would equal about 21 cents per diluted share, but would result in annual cost savings of 11 cents a share beginning fiscal 2000. State health officials in New York have ordered social services agencies to get rid of all homemade pies donated for the sick and shut-ins this Thanksgiving. The health workers are worried about bacteria problems if the pies sit unrefrigerated for hours before being sliced and packed for delivery. Store-bought pies are okay because they contain more preservatives. At this hour, the Dow is down more than 52 points at 93.27. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 48 years ago, a depressed, insecure kid named Charlie Brown took his place next to Lil Abner, Steve Canyon, and Prince Valiant on the comics pages of the dailies. Peanuts has since become one of the most famous comic strips in the world, but Charlie Brown has always stayed kind of unhappy.
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel. I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
That's from A Charlie Brown Christmas, which was first broadcast in 1965 and has since become an annual TV tradition. CBS reran it earlier this week. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1990 interview with the creator of Peanuts, Charles Schulz. He's still drawing it today. We spoke to Schulz from his studio in Santa Rosa, California.
Do you put in things into Peanuts that you think and feel now, or do you feel that you rely on memory about how children react to things?
I don't think much about children, actually, and I don't regard this at all as being a strip for children. I think that drawing a comic strip for children would be a wonderful thing, but I think it would be extremely difficult. I don't know of anybody these days who is drawing a really good strip for children. And in the history of comics, which I suppose could be about 80 years, I can think of only three or four who are ever really drawn for children. So I just draw what I think is funny and what thoughts come to me and what things work out. And I suppose you could say I simply draw for myself.
Now, you get older while the characters you draw stay the same age. Do you think that they've changed as you've grown?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that the characters have changed. I think the entire strip, the whole outlook, is much more mild from what it used to be. I don't think the characters are quite as sarcastic as they used to be, because I probably myself am not quite as sarcastic as I used to be. I think as you grow older, you begin to see both sides of issues more clearly. And my approach is just different, that's all, as I've gotten older.
There's a Peanuts from, I forget the year, it's in the 1950s, where I think it's Linus shows Charlie Brown a scar, and he asks Charlie Brown if he has any scars, and Charlie Brown says, oh, I have lots of them, but they're all mental.
Yeah.
And I think in a way that kind of sums up Charlie Brown's view of life, you know, the mental scars.
Yeah.
Did you find any reluctance in newspapers at the time to take on a subject like depression or mental scars, you know?
No, I don't recall anybody ever complaining about that. What editors were afraid of in those days, much more than now, was the mention of personalities in things. There used to be a very wonderful lady who had a program out of Chicago called Miss Francis. And I used to watch it with my little kids all of the time. And I mentioned her name in a comic strip one day, and some editor complained. He said, we shouldn't be promoting things like that. Well, now people mention almost everything. And of course, comic strip characters are saying things which they never would have said even 10, 12, 15 years ago. They're actually beginning to swear in comic strips now, which I think is a bad policy.
Well, the closest you've come to swearing in a comic is probably Good Grief.
I have discovered in my life that good grief and rats will cover almost anything that ever happens to you.
How did you start using good grief, which has really become a popular part of the vocabulary?
It was just a natural thing that I always said. If I was playing golf and I missed a 3-foot putt, I might say, oh, good grief, you know. But I've never been one who swore. I've never liked ugly words. I have nothing against, you know, I'm not a purist in that way, but I like words to a certain extent. I'm not well educated so that I'm an expert on them, but I've never cared for any type of ugly language, even words that are not considered swearing words.
Do you think of the characters in Peanuts as each representing a different side of your own character?
I think there's no doubt about it. I doubt that it would be possible to do something every day with a group of characters such as I have without each one of those characters being a little bit of myself or being a little bit of the creator. I think this is the only way you can do it. This is why I suppose the characters do change little by little. I try to be consistent in their personalities, but I also think that none of us is ever really consistent in the things that we do and say. We all have our little good points and bad points, and this is what the characters have. I kind of like the theory that my son Monty has. He called me one day and he says, I've been thinking about your characters, you know, and I've come to the conclusion that Charlie Brown is really the smartest one of the whole group. And I had never even thought much about it, but I have a feeling that he's right.
What part of yourself is Charlie Brown about?
Not as much as people like to think. It just makes a good story, of course. I have not been the loser that Charlie Brown has, although I can remember certainly losses in both baseball and golf and hockey that go back 50 years, and I'm still suffering from them. I think Charlie Brown and I are alike in that we are both fanatics about certain things. I was the same sort of little kid that Charlie Brown was. I looked forward to the baseball games that we were going to have, and if it was raining, I would have been the kind that would have stood out in the rain and saying, where's everybody going? You know, let's play the game. Come on, let's go. You know, I was just dedicated to things like that, and I suppose it's the dedication to drawing that has kept me going these 40 years, because I am completely dedicated to what I do.
Do you get depressed like Charlie Brown?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've been depressed the last few days.
About
I never quite know why.
About what, do you know?
For one thing, we are in the midst of doing a wonderful ice show here at my ice arena, and there's something about seeing all the beautiful, bright young people out there performing, and I listen to the music. The music brings back memories to me, and I suppose I'm just sensitive to that kind of thing. I don't think I'm any more sensitive than anyone else is, but they do affect me. And little things like that do tend to make me feel depressed. Although Rita Grimsley Johnson wrote a book about me a couple of years ago called Good Grief, and she mentions in there my depression. And I think the use of the word depression is almost wrong. I don't know what word would be more suitable, but I don't think that I am what you would call a depressed person by any means.
Well, you know, when a child is depressed, like or anxious, like Charlie Brown often is, I think that adults sometimes don't understand it and think, you know, that childhood should be a time when kids are more carefree.
Oh yeah.
I was wondering if you were exposed to a lot of that when you were young, of adults maybe not understanding your moods, and your interior self.
I don't know about the moods, but I think the word anxiety is much more appropriate than depression.
Yeah.
I think I am a very anxious person. Now, my childhood was a good childhood, but there were episodes in our neighborhood where there were some cruel children, a couple of boys, and there's one of them. If I ever see him again sometime, I'm going to kill him. they caused me much unhappiness, and I think this is something that adults tend to forget. It's very difficult out there in the playground to survive. It's a struggle out there. And as we grow older, we drift away from that and we learn how to protect ourselves. But children are defenseless. And if they are forced to be out on that playground and they are too small or they're inadequate in some ways and they just can't defend themselves, it can be a very miserable life.
Now let's get to Lucy. Lucy has a Lucy has a psychiatry booth.
Yeah.
Were you ever in therapy or do you have any faith in therapy?
I don't know enough about it to say I have faith or not. I went through a few sessions over this anxiety business, but the psychiatric booth is really a takeoff, a parody of the old lemonade stands that used to be in comic strips.
Oh, yeah, well, sure.
Yeah. When I was growing up, every comic strip character at some time or another ran a little lemonade stand. And so I was thinking about that one day, and I thought, well, nowadays it'd be much more practical to have a psychiatric booth, and that's how that all started.
How did you come up with Linus's security blanket?
I would say out of the five children that we had, three of them had blankets. And two of them carried the blankets around until they literally crumbled and disappeared. Little by little, chunks would fall off each day until finally there was nothing left. And that was the end of the blanket. And that's what gave me the idea for it. I was always glad that I was the first one who noticed it and used it, because I know if I had not, that Mort Walker, who was very bright, would have latched onto the same idea.
Your father and Charlie Brown's father were both barbers. Now, Charlie Brown has no hair. He has that one little lock that comes out.
I don't think of it as not having hair. I think of it as being hair that is so blonde that it just doesn't, it's not seen very clearly, that's all.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if your father always gave you too close of a shave when he cut your hair.
No, but he always gave me haircuts, and when I went to school, I was always looking very nice. My hair was neatly combed, but the embarrassing thing about that was when I used to go into the shop, and he'd be working on me, and maybe he'd be halfway through my haircut, and a real good customer would come in, and he would say, why don't you just sit over there and wait for a little bit, because I have to wait on this man. It was so embarrassing to sit on the bench with just a half a haircut.
Oh, yeah.
My guest is Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts.
What did you draw before you started doing Peanuts?
I tried several other comic strips. I always wanted to do something about the Foreign Legion for some reason, which is why Snoopy now leads his legionnaires across the desert. And I had another character about a little girl who was kind of a tomboy. I tried to sell her at different times, but it didn't go over. But I discovered little by little, by the few cartoons that I sold to the Saturday Evening Post, that when I drew little kids, these seemed to be the type of cartoons that editors liked the best.
What was the first strip that you did with a Charlie Brown or Charlie Brown kind of character in it? Did it start off as the strip that we know now, or was there a more, was there an earlier version of it?
No, but the original submission to United Features was a panel rather than a strip, so there were no definite characters. And then when I went to New York to sign the contract, I took along a batch of about a half a dozen strips I had been working on just to show them what else I could do. And they said immediately that they would much rather have a strip than a panel, because a strip just is easier to sell, it's easier to market. So then they said, well, you'll have to create some definite characters. So I said, well, that's no problem, because I already knew I liked to draw a little dog. And I just went home and I asked my friend Charlie Brown if I could use his name. And he said that was fine. And so I created Patty and Shermie, and those were the four lead characters. The first strip that ever appeared, I wish I had never drawn, It shows Shermie and Patty sitting on a curb, and they see Charlie Brown coming from a distance. And Shermie says, "Here comes Charlie Brown. Yes, sir, good old Charlie Brown." And as he walks by, he says, "How I hate him." See, that shows what I was doing those days, which I would never do now.
Well, why are you sorry that you drew that, though?
Well, I don't think he should have said something like, "How I hate him." It's a little too strong. Nowadays, I think I would make it more mild.
Now, I know that when you first submitted your comic to the syndicate, that they changed the name. They just came up with the name of Peanuts, and you didn't like the name.
Probably the worst title ever thought of for a comic strip, and I always make sure that when I am interviewed that I say this, because I like to get revenge. But it is totally inappropriate. It has nothing to do with what I am drawing. But I don't think the people at the syndicate, even though they were wonderful gentlemen, and I owe them a good deal because we've become close friends, but I don't think they had any comprehension of what I was going to do. I think the difficulty of being a syndicate editor is that you have to realize the potential of this young person who is sitting across from you when you are looking at his or her work. Is this person a fanatic, or is he or she just somebody who's doing something for a lark? And they should have recognized immediately that here they had somebody who was a fanatic and somebody who was really dedicated. They should have listened to me a little more carefully. Fortunately, titles of comic strips are not that important. Who knows that Popeye is really called Thimble Theater? It's really not important.
What's wrong with Peanuts?
Peanuts, in the first place, is insignificant. It indicates something that is not very important. And also, it is not the name of the lead character, which is what I said would deceive people when the strip first began, and it certainly proved to be true. I just hate it when somebody says, "Oh, I liked what Peanuts and his dog did the other day." That drives me crazy.
No, so what title did you want to give it?
I think I would have liked to have called it Good Old Charlie Brown. But as the years have gone on, I realized that Snoopy would simply have been the best name because he has turned out to be the lead character. But we didn't know that, of course, at the time.
Now, have you ever hired artists to draw for you like most people who do newspaper strips end up doing?
I would quit before I do that. The only way I suppose that it could happen would be if I had a temporary illness and I simply couldn't keep up the schedule. But even then, I think we would just drop the strip until I became well again. Before I had heart surgery, I worked very hard and I got 3 months ahead on the strip because I didn't know how much time I would lose. As it turned out, I only lost a month. But I hope that no one else ever touches the strip because the strip is me. And this doesn't mean that I'm critical of others who do have assistance. Some of them certainly need them. But I would never want anybody else to do it. And my children feel the same way. And they insisted in putting in our syndicate contract that when I retire or die, the strip goes too, because they said, and I quote, "We don't want anybody else drawing Dad's strip."
Do you have any plans to retire?
All my friends are retiring, and it annoys me to talk to people who are even younger than myself. And I say, "What are you doing these days?" "Oh, I'm retired." "What are you doing?" Well, what really annoys me, Terry, is when they say, "Oh, are you still drawing the strip?" I feel that they should recognize that someone else has not been doing the strip, that it is such a personal strip, such a personal form of creativity, and it really is insulting that they think we could just go out and find somebody else to do it. Now, maybe it could happen, but I like to think, I'm egotistical enough to think that they just can't find somebody else to do it.
Have you ever wanted to do a strip besides Peanuts?
Yes, I never will. I've often thought that I would have liked to have drawn a strip about real children, with the cartooning not being as exaggerated as it is with mine, with the larger heads and the little tiny bodies. I think there is something there. However, we are now caught in this terrible bind where we have such small space in which to work that it would be almost impossible to do something like that.
Is it loyalty to Peanuts also that would hold you back from doing a different strip?
Yeah, because I like what I have, and I think that every thought that comes to me can be used in the Peanuts strip in some way or another. I never think of something and say, well, gee, I wish I could use that, but it just won't work in my strip. I have a repertory group here that will accommodate anything that I can think of, whether it's something fairly serious, you know, like certain scriptural references, something from the Old Testament, way on down to something really corny, and then I'll give it to Snoopy, and he'll tell Woodstock something which is just absurd and corny, and they both laugh so hard they fall off the doghouse and land on their heads. those things are really fun, and that's what cartooning is all about. I think that cartoonists have to be very much aware of their medium, because you cannot compete with live actors, television actors, movie actors, radio actors, on their own ground. You have to remember that you can do things that they can't do. Cartoon characters can flip over and do things that live actors can't do, but they can do things that we can't do. So you always must be aware of your own medium.
Charles Schulz, recorded in 1990, he's still drawing Peanuts. The Peanuts Christmas special at Charlie Brown Christmas was broadcast earlier this week.
May I help you?
I'm in sad shape.
Wait a minute. Before you begin, I must ask that you pay in advance. 5 cents, please. Boy, what a sound! How I love to hear that old money clink. That beautiful sound of cold, hard cash. That beautiful, beautiful sound. Nickels, nickels, nickels. That beautiful sound of clinking nickels. All right, now. What seems to be your trouble?
I feel depressed. I know I should be happy, but I'm not.
Well, as they say on TV, the mere fact that you realize you need help indicates that you are not too far gone. I think we better pinpoint your fears. If we can find out what you're afraid of, we can label it. Are you afraid of responsibility? If you are, then you have hypangeophobia.
I don't think that's quite it.
How about cats? If you're afraid of cats, you have ailerophasia.
Well, sort of, but I'm not sure.
Are you afraid of staircases? If you are, then you have climacophobia. Maybe you have thalassophobia. This is fear of the ocean. Or gephyrophobia, which is the fear of crossing bridges. Or maybe you have pantophobia. Do you think you have pantophobia?
What's pantophobia?
The fear of everything. That's it!
A Peanuts musical called You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is scheduled to open on Broadway in February. Here's Vince Guaraldi's tune, Charlie Brown, played by pianist Ellis Marsalis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, David Sedaris reads from his book, Holidays on Ice, and tells us about his Christmas family traditions. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz suggests an alternative to the holiday music you're already tired of. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On television, Christmas season means it's time for A Charlie Brown Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life, and A Christmas Carol. But on public radio, it means time for The Santaland Diaries, David Sedaris' funny and cynical journal of the season he worked as an elf in Macy's Santaland. The Santaland Diaries are included in his collection of Christmas-related stories called Holidays on Ice. Sedaris' stories and journal entries are featured on Morning Edition and This American Life. Several of his plays have been produced in New York. Last December, we invited him to talk with us about Christmas in his family and to read an excerpt of one of the stories in Holidays on Ice. This story shows what might happen if a tough-minded and pretentious drama critic reviewed Christmas plays staged by elementary school kids.
Front row center with Thaddeus Bristol. Trite Christmas. Scottsfield's young hams offer the blandest of holiday fare. The approach of Christmas signifies three things: bad movies, unforgivable television, and even worse, theater. I'm talking bone-crushing theater, the type our ancient ancestors used to oppress their enemies before the invention of the stretching rack. We're talking torture on a par with the Scottsfield Dinner Theater's 1994 revival of Come Blow Your Horn, a production that violated every tenet of the Human Rights Accord. To those of you who enjoy the comfort of a nice set of thumbscrews, allow me to recommend any of the crucifying holiday plays and pageants currently eliciting screams of mercy from within the confines of our local elementary and middle schools. I will, no doubt, be taken to task for criticizing the work of children, but as any pathologist will agree, if there's a cancer, it's best to treat it as soon as possible. Once again, the sadists at the Jane Snow Hernandez Middle School have taken up their burning pokers in an attempt to prod A Christmas Carol into some form of submission. I might have overlooked the shoddy production values and dry, leaden pacing, but these are sixth graders we're talking about, and they should have known better. There's really no point in adapting this Dickensian stinker unless you're capable of looking beyond the novel's dime store morality and getting to what little theatrical meat the story has to offer. The point is to eviscerate the gooey center, but here it's served up as an entree, and a foul pudding it is. Most of the blame goes to the director, 11-year-old Becky Michaels, who seems to have picked up her staging secrets from the school's crossing guard. She tends to clump her actors, moving them only in groups of five or more. A strong proponent of trendy, racially mixed casting, Michaels gives us a black Tiny Tim, leaving the audience to wonder, what is this kid supposed to be adopted? It's a distracting move, wrong-headed and pointless. The role was played by young Lamar Williams, who, if nothing else, managed to sustain a decent limp. The program notes that he had recently lost his right foot to diabetes, but was that reason enough to cast him? As Tiny Tim, the boy spends his stage time essentially trawling for sympathy, stealing focus from even the brightly lit exit sign. Bob Cratchit, played here by the aptly named Benjamin Trite, seems to have picked up his Cockney accent by watching a few videotaped episodes of Hee Haw, and Herschel Fleischman's Scrooge was almost as lame as Tiny Tim. The set was not without its charm, but Jody Lennon's abysmal costumes should hopefully mark the end of a short and unremarkable career. I was gagging from the smell of spray-painted sneakers, and if I see one more top hat made from an oatmeal canister, I swear to God I'm going to pull out a gun. The problem with all these shows stems partially from their maddening eagerness to please. With smiles stretched tight as bungee cords, these hopeless amateurs pranced and gambled across our local stages, hiding behind their youth and begging, practically demanding we forgive their egregious mistakes. The English language was chewed into a paste, missed opportunities came and went, and the sets were changed so slowly you'd think the stagehands were encumbered by full-body casts. While billing themselves as holiday entertainment, none of these productions came close to capturing the true spirit of Christmas. This glaring irony seemed to escape the throngs of ticket holders who ate these undercooked turkeys right down to the bone. Here were audiences that chuckled at every technical snafu and applauded riotously each time a new character wandered out onto the stage. With the close of every curtain, they leapt to their feet in one ovation after another, leaving me wedged into my doll-sized chair and wondering, is it just them Or am I missing something?
David Sedaris reading an excerpt of one of his stories from his collection, Holidays on Ice. Thanks for reading that, David. I'm wondering what made you think about, a theater critic who goes to sixth grade school productions and applies his astringent facilities on these sixth graders.
I was in France when I was writing these stories, and I had a stack of old New York magazines there. And John Simon is a theater critic for New York Magazine. And I may have missed it, but to my knowledge, he has never liked anything. So I was just thinking that what if a person like him was assigned to review children's theater? Because if you were a child, if you're 7 years old, what do you do with this review?
Oh, really? Did you participate in school Christmas plays when you were a kid?
I didn't go to, I went to a public school. I think if I had gone to a Christian school, I probably would have snagged the part of a donkey or a shepherd or something. But no, I was never, our school would have a pageant every year. Just a very simple thing, but it was mainly the students would dress up and get on stage, and then they would pull out all the janitors. And the janitors would receive dented cans of fruit cocktail or cans of Crisco. And then the janitors would bow their heads and thank us for it, and that was the pageant.
Wow. your most famous story, The Santaland Diaries, is collected in this new Christmas collection, Holidays on Ice. And I'm wondering if you've ever gone back to Macy's Santaland, where you once worked as a Christmas elf, just as an observer to see what it's like now.
No, but I got a call last week from a former Santa, because Macy's changed their Santaland this year. They spent millions of dollars, and my understanding is that now it's like an interactive Santaland.
Like with computers and stuff?
Yeah, the children were having riots. You know, they were waiting for 2 hours to see Santa, and all they saw were some elves and a couple of candy canes, and that wasn't enough for them. So they've spent a lot of money, and I just read an article about it in the newspaper, but apparently there's, I don't know, virtual, because I don't have a computer, I don't even know exactly what these words mean, but something about it is virtual.
You don't have a computer?
And maybe you can send Santa email. I don't know. No, I've never touched one. So whenever I hear words like .org, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Do you hear from a lot of current and former Santaland elves who want to commiserate with you?
I hear from former elves and Santas who have written screenplays. Those are the former elves and Santas that I tend to hear from.
My guest is David Sedaris. His collection of Christmas-related stories is called Holidays on Ice. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Sedaris. Now, I want to talk to you more about what Christmas is like for you and what it's been like for you. What was Christmas like in your family when you were growing up? Did your family celebrate it or give gifts?
Oh, we were very involved in Christmas. I mean, we still are. You know, Christmas begins the day after Halloween, basically, and then everything is just this march towards Christmas. And, oh, we're big gift givers. And I love Christmas. Absolutely love it.
What went on in your house on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day?
Well, when we were children, we had to go to church on Christmas Eve, but it was a Greek Orthodox church, and so it was pretty, and they were, still you just wanted to get out of there, but it didn't take that long. And we would usually be up all night, wrapping gifts or... By the time we were a teenager, by the time we were old enough to smoke pot, we were definitely awake all night. And, but not with that, oh, I think I hear Santa thing. That's like, I think I hear Dad coming downstairs, throw the roach out the window kind of thing. But no, we were really, gosh, I'm, I mean, my mom always made, my mom was kind of in charge of, my mother was responsible for making Christmas so wonderful. You know, just doing mom things. You know, baking mom things and buying mom kind of gifts and putting, you know, wreaths on the door that we would just make fun of, but still we were glad that they were there.
What are some of the best gifts you ever got?
I got an electric typewriter, which really changed my life. I'd been using a manual typewriter forever. And then at the age of 32, my mother gave me an electric typewriter where you could correct things. You know, you could go up two lines and that word would be gone. And that was a present that really changed my life. Last year, I got a really nice taxidermied ostrich, a little baby ostrich. That was a nice gift.
Who gave that to you?
My sister Gretchen gave me a stuffed ostrich. It is just adorable. It's about a foot tall. I got a lot of taxidermy last year for Christmas, and that's always a good gift. Gosh, you know, I mean, I've never received, like, the title to a country home or anything like that. It's
maybe next year. But do you remember the worst gift you ever got?
The worst gift I ever got was probably a football helmet, which I had absolutely no use for whatsoever.
I can only
That's not
imagine.
Even good for storing things.
Who gave it to you?
My father.
Was that wishful thinking on his part?
He went through a phase where all of the gifts that he gave me would hopefully wake me up to the world of sports. So maybe I would have asked for a discreet, you know, portable tape recorder so I could spy on people, and instead I would get a child-sized set of golf clubs, which the cat was the only person who would enjoy them. She would just shred the golf bag to bits, but she was more than welcome to them.
And what about you as a gift giver? Are you a careful and thoughtful gift giver?
I think I am. I always feel so bad. You know, when people say, well, I'm going to do my shopping on Christmas Eve, I feel bad for the people that they're giving gifts to, because you're not going to find anything on Christmas Eve. That kind of panic buying that people do.
Mm-hmm.
I love watching it, and I'll still go to the store on Christmas Eve just so I can see people that panic.
But do you really do that?
Yes. I have. I love, like, the same way I love going to the grocery store the night before Thanksgiving. And I'll just buy a head of lettuce, but I'm more than happy to stand in that line for 45 minutes just to see people at the breaking point. But I have a few things to buy, but for the most part, I finished my shopping by August.
Really? So you must always be thinking about potential gifts for people.
Well, I don't think about it in February, but I think about it by March.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to shop, and this gives me a reason to do so.
Did you ever go caroling during your life?
No, carolers are one of those things that even my mother would be like, don't answer the door, don't answer the door. They're at the Shirk's house, or they're coming this way. Turn out the lights, hide. Because I don't know how you respond. Do you know what I mean? Like when you open the door and then there's people there singing and they're looking at you. It's like you just give them the money now and maybe they'll go away or maybe they'll stop. Caroling is what it's like mime to me. It's just one of those things where I don't know what choice the spectator really has. It's just so uncomfortable.
You live in Manhattan now. There probably aren't a lot of people out caroling in Manhattan.
Well, I don't have to worry about them coming to the door in my apartment. Someone would have to buzz them in. And so I don't worry about them coming to my door. And that's a good thing about living in a city.
You know, when you're young, you spend Christmas the way your parents spend it. When you get older, you have the option of, you know, maybe doing it with friends or whatever. You're not necessarily home with your family. Do you remember, like, the first Christmas that you were old enough to decide for yourself how you were going to spend it?
I'm 40 years old, and I've never missed a Christmas at home.
Really?
Never.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't really expect good presents unless you're going to show up and get them in person. And if somebody thinks that they can mail you something, then you're liable to get anything. You're liable to get a pound cake or something like that. But if they know that they have to face you and hand you a gift, then you're much better off by going home. I can't, There's no other place I would want to be for Christmas, really, than with my brothers and sisters.
David, I would like to end our Christmas interview with by asking you to sing a rendition of one of your favorite Christmas songs, a song that is a favorite because you particularly love it or hate it.
Well, somebody sends us a tape every year of different obscure Christmas songs that he puts together. And there's one, and I don't quite have all the words, but it's like a really obnoxious child with a full voice, almost like a young Wayne Newton voice. and it's, I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus will do. Don't want a dinky, I want a hippopotamus to play with and enjoy. I can see it now on Christmas morning creeping down the stairs. Oh, what joy and what surprise when I open up my eyes and see a hippo hero standing there. I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. And then he restates again and again reasons why he wants a hippopotamus and the fact that the hippopotamus will most likely be a vegetarian. That's the gist of the song. But I can listen to it over and over and over again. It's just so confident. And it's not a and it's not like a wacky song, you know, like not like when they have babies crying out Silent Night or dogs barking it or something. It's really just a wonderful little song. And I don't even know the fellow's name who sang it.
David Sedaris, recorded last year after the publication of his book Holidays on Ice. He'll read more of his holiday stories on the Christmas edition of the public radio program This American Life. Here's a track from Etta James' new CD, 12 Songs of Christmas.
Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. You gave me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise. Well, I'm feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my radio. Well, I'm feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my radio. You, baby, while you're standing near the mistletoe.
Coming up, an alternative to the holiday music you're already tired of, this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Now that Christmas music is everywhere, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a suggestion for people tired of the same old tunes.
Stop! I have to admit, I'm bored with most Christmas music. It's either the same old carols, Jingle Bell Rock in elevators, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, or Handel's Messiah. I love them all, but I'm tired of them, and too many performances express the same old pieties instead of real feeling. So it was a pleasure to receive a new disc by the estimable Chicago-based choral group His Majesty's Clarks, with something completely different on it, something beautiful, and delivered with spiritual fervor and grace. It's an album called Hear My Prayer, Choral Music of the English Romantics. Surprisingly, the three pieces on this album were all composed in the 20th century, which suggests that in English choral music, the Romantic period arrived, or stayed, a little late. According to the liner notes by the group's director, Anne Hyder, what makes something romantic is a preference for the distant rather than the immediate past. A preference evidently shared by Hyder and His Majesty's Clarks, Majesty ending not with a Y but an I-E, and Clarks spelled C-L-E-R-K-E-S. Even in 1922, Ralph Vaughan Williams's luscious Mass in G minor was attacked for being old-fashioned. But who could have predicted back then that medieval Gregorian chant, which is how the Vaughan Williams Mass begins, would top the charts in the 1990s? The earliest selections on this disc, from 1905, are three lovely Latin motets by Vaughan Williams's tyrannical teacher, Charles Villiers Stanford, who to a large degree determined the conservative trend in 20th century British music. The piece on the album I'm especially fond of is Oxford music professor Hubert Parry's Songs of Farewell, six motets he composed during World War I and completed in 1918, the year he died. The texts Parry sets, mostly 17th century, including Psalm 39, seem to reflect his thoughts about his own mortality. The poem by Sir John Davies concludes, "I know myself a man, which is a proud and yet a wretched thing." John Donne's apocalyptic holy sonnet, At the Round Earth's Imagined Corners, becomes more quietly ecstatic than you'd expect. Henry Vaughan's My Soul, There is a Country Far Beyond the Stars is a moving plea for peace and spiritual stability in a time of world devastation. The ending is particularly wondrous, with its surprising and ironic tonal changes on the word changes. If thou canst get but thither, there grows the flower of peace, the rose that cannot wither, thy fortress and thy ease. leave then thy foolish ranges. For none can thee secure but one who never changes, thy God, thy life, thy cure. Hear My Prayer is not specifically a Christmas album, which makes it all the more appealing at what's supposed to be not only a season of joy, but also a time of spiritual contemplation.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Hear My Prayer, Choral Music of the English Romantics, on the Chicago label CD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock with Kathy Wolf. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.